So I came across a line by the poet Michael Palmer from his book, The Promises of Glass. And the line is, "You must have confused me with myself." In Portraits of American Philosophy, published in 2013, Stephen Kahn relates how he was motivated to found these lectures while he was serving as president of the John Dewey Foundation. Kahn had observed that recently deceased philosophers were accorded moments of silence at American Philosophical Association divisional meetings. He thought this did not do justice to their careers, lives, and struggles. He therefore sought to create a reflective forum for senior distinguished philosophers. He did not add the clause, quote, "while they are still alive," but I think that's understood. I am not completely comfortable with this memento mori genre, because although I was born in 1944, I'm not expecting to die soon. But how long is soon? Also, the American Philosophical Association specifies that most speakers in this series are retired. While I have no plans to retire at this time, I will eventually retire. So thank you, Stephen Kahn. Thank you, Rebecca Becko, Copenhaver, and all on this year's nominating committee. And thank you, James Madden, for introducing me in a way that implies I am worthy of this honor. In reading the accounts by my John Dewey predecessors that Kahn collected, I was impressed and not a little intimidated by how academically respectable, disciplined, restrained, and well-connected they all were. None seemed to have taught at state or public colleges or universities. Neither had they built their academic careers on the social political issues that I've been able to pursue. Compared to them, I'm not a normal academic philosopher. There appear to have been, another note on this collection, no people of color in that volume, but Charles Mills did give the 2016 Dewey Lecture at the APA Central Division. You might think that part of the reason I'm here is that I am a mixed race woman who has written extensively about race. But I do not believe that racial or ethnic identity is that deep, although parts of gender may be. So I'm beginning this by resisting death, retirement, race, and parts of gender. And I would like you to consider that I am the daughter of an artist. My mother, Ruth Zack, was an artist. Despite several marriages and divorces, I still use her maiden name that she also used professionally. She made her living with quick portrait sketches at fairs, events, and in the toy department at Macy's. By the time I was in college in the late 1960s, she owned portrait studios in Greenwich Village where other artists also worked. But her real work in oil and clay never sold. And after she died in 1983, I inherited an oeuvre of over 100 paintings and many terracotta sculptures, which proved to be quite fragile. She was my sole parent. We were poor during my childhood, and we lived in a three-room Coldwater Railroad flat on Suffolk Street in the Lower East Side. The household reading material consisted of the Reader's Digest, the New York Daily News, and True Confession magazine, which I really loved. There was also hidden away a 19th century edition of Father Sebastian Kneipp's Water Cures that my grandfather had consulted in helping my mother recover from polio when she was two. My grandfather was a Hebrew teacher and an herbalist. My grandmother raised six children and tried to write plays for the Yiddish theater. Both had been born in Vilnius and they immigrated to the United States in about 1900. I will tell you about my father and his antecedents later. I've had three encounters or relationships with philosophy over my life, and my account here is structured by those encounters. First encounter. My first encounter with philosophy occurred when my high school social studies teacher sent me to the New York Public Library to look up and report back on a passage by Aristotle. It was a section about the golden mean from the Nicomachean Ethics. And I don't remember it being identified as philosophy or even ethics. I sat and took notes without understanding the forest, but something about the trees was comprehensible to me. In presenting my report to the class, I exposited Aristotle's idea of the golden mean using my own as well as Aristotle's words. Somehow, this made sense to my teacher, who asked to have my notes to use for a night class that he was taking. I did not deeply reflect on this incident at the time, but in recounting it now, I think I must have grasped Aristotle's concept of the mean. It took me a long time to understand what concepts are. One grasps a concept or a thought that may be embedded in a conception that specifies it. Concepts are what George Berkeley so contemptuously dismissed as abstract general ideas. Examples include redness, justice, kindness, democracy, and racism, as well as the golden mean. These abstract general ideas or concepts are important starting points in philosophy because their vagueness allows many to be drawn in and then argue about the resulting conceptions or their creation of the conceptions. So now for my second encounter with philosophy. My mother wanted me to become a medical doctor. She was a struggling single parent as well as a neglected artist, but her self-esteem was very high, and a doctor daughter would have fulfilled that. I was a good student, earning New York State Regents scholarships while enrolled at New York University, and I probably could have successfully completed the pre-med program if I was passionately committed. But I was squeamish about blood and gore and confounded by organic chemistry. So I revised my mother's ambition to the goal of becoming a psychiatrist. But when I found that required a medical degree, I chose psychology as my major. My mother not only accepted this, but years after I had a PhD in philosophy, she would refer to me as having a degree in psychology. I changed my major from psychology to philosophy the summer before my senior year. My reasons were principal to me, although others may have the same reasons for avoiding philosophy. In my psychology courses at that time, what I thought were innocent questions were quickly shut down, whereas in my philosophy courses, professors would take them up. Sometimes an argument would ensue, although the give and take was not without limits. Paul Edwards became so exasperated with my persistent criticism of David Hume's theory of causation that he expelled me from class one day. There was no lasting hostility on either side, although I don't think I asked him for a recommendation letter for graduate school. I very much liked the philosophical practice of disagreement without anger. I enrolled in the PhD program in philosophy at Columbia University. When it came time to write my dissertation, now in defense of Hume, with an idea of atomic events as an endpoint of constant conjunction analyses, I came up against limits to the kind of free inquiry I took for granted. It was relatively easy to get a dissertation proposal approved at Columbia at that time, but the project wasn't underway until the first chapter was approved. I was asked to revise my first chapter numerous times, and the department unilaterally changed my committee chair from an august senior faculty member to a junior member of the department who was looked at askance because he had left academia for 2 years. I continually answered all questions and revisions, but was finally told that although I had done that, should my work be severely criticized after publication, it could reflect unfavorably on the new committee chair as well as the department. This first chapter process took the better part of my third year in the program. I was very frustrated, and I talked to James Walsh, who was then department chair, and asked him if I had any rights in the matter. He set me straight by explaining that a dissertation was supposed to be a discussion of the literature, and he said he would send me to Sydney. Sydney Morgenbesser read my first chapter and said it was good and said it was worth pursuing, but that he wanted to send me to talk to a number of well-known philosophers up and down the East Coast. I asked him how long it would take for me to get the PhD, and his answer was about 12 years. I told him I was not going to commit to 12 more years to get a PhD in a field that I was beginning to think might not be for me. He told me that the department would be grateful if I would write a dissertation on the epistemology of C.I. Lewis. He explained the scholarly work would not involve long hours in library stacks. They used to have these multiple lower levels in the library at Columbia, because all of the relevant secondary material had recently been collected in one volume by Paul Arthur Shilp. Lewis was by then a neglected Harvard University scholar who had had strong ties to the Columbia University Philosophy Department. The department wanted to revive his work. I leapt at the opportunity. I had a proposal submitted in 1 week, a first chapter in a month, and the rest of my dissertation was done in 4 months. Lewis was obscure at that time, although he had been the most famous American philosopher of his generation about 10 years previously. Lewis was still obscure when I taught a course on him at the University of Oregon in 2004, gave papers on his work at the UO Summer Institute, and wrote an essay book review about Murray Murphy's C.I. Lewis, The Last Great Pragmatist, which had come out in 2000. 2000. My biographical research for those efforts suggested reasons for Lewis's obscurity. His student, W.V. O'Quine, had demolished the analytic synthetic distinction on which so much of Lewis's work relied. And as a person, Lewis was unfeeling in his family life, and he may also have been an anti-Semite. At any rate, to this day, people assume that when I say C.I. Lewis, I really mean C.S. Lewis. While I have not been interested in furthering a renaissance, I do think that Lewis remains important as the last philosopher in the Anglo-American analytic tradition who considered the relationship between language and that to which language refers. My committee liked my dissertation, The Epistemology of C.I. Lewis, and praised its what they called philosophical tact. They passed me in the first column, and to my surprise, I was soon offered a position as assistant professor in the Barnard Philosophy Department. In some schools at that time, one did not have to apply for jobs in order to get such offers. Those in charge of hiring simply made an offer in confidence that it would be accepted. I was 25. Young enough to be severely disillusioned by the limits I had encountered, and also not a little disgusted with how easily I had given in to the discussion of the literature expectation. I was also nostalgic for my life outside of academia, which I had never fully experienced. So I turned the Barnard offer down, and I left philosophy and academia. And I thought I was done with academia because I had been severely disillusioned. And when I left academia, with that, I left academic philosophy. It became a 20-year absence. None of my work projects that included freelance writing, small business ventures, investments in the stock market, and filmmaking succeeded, and neither did my marriages. But I had two sons, and I now have two granddaughters, and I'm very grateful for and proud of all of them. And those are the ties that really justify everything else. My mother had supplemented my feeble income during my long absence from academia, and she left me some money when she died, but it eventually ran out. I was a little desperate by my mid-40s, not knowing what I could do to make a secure living with a modicum of respectability and a pension plan, not to mention possibly medical insurance. And toward the end of my long absence from academic philosophy, I read or reread Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex. I was inspired by her discussion of how women towards the end of their romantic careers had few options. She wrote that they sometimes tried to return to a skill or occupation for which they'd been trained in youth, but that it usually failed. I decided to return to academic philosophy. And now my third encounter. My third encounter with philosophy began in 1990. I taught adjunct for a year and a half at SUNY Albany, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and via correspondence at Empire State College. During this time, I began to write for publication and seek a tenure-related job. When I had been a student up through the PhD, neither feminism nor race existed as subjects. And now both of these innovations are well established and there are also many more possible to pursue. I had confirmed who my father was at the age of 16. He was an African-American, a gardener, and he had 8 children in marriage and perhaps as many more from relationships with other women. He appeared sporadically in my mother's life while I was growing up, but he was never part of my life. His father had been 2 years old at the beginning of the Civil War. That is, his father had been born into slavery and was emancipated at age 6. My father's mother was Native American. The couple met when my grandfather left Virginia to work in the oil fields of Oklahoma. My mother was reticent about my paternity because despite her bohemian lifestyle, she had conventional ideas about race and race relations. Having a Jewish mother during the time when American Jews were increasingly being recognized as generically white, but a Black father, resulted in a complex of shame and denial for me. Upon my return, philosophy became therapy. I began to read and write about race. I also dusted off some of my graduate studies in the history of philosophy. We had had a first year reading exam in the Columbia program based on John Locke's essay concerning human understanding. And I remembered some of that, as well as Heidegger's Being and Time. And of course, that section from the Nicomachean Ethics from my first encounter with philosophy. When I started teaching, I heard people talking about new preparations, complaining about new preparations. Every course I taught then was a new preparation. However, there is something called savings in psychology. If you learn something once and forget it, you learn it more easily the second time, as well as other times that follow, more easily than if you had never learned it. And savings worked very well for me. I published 2 articles that came out in the spring of 1992, Locke's Identity, Meaning of Ownership, and an autobiographical view of mixed race and deracination. The Locke piece analyzed how Locke's theory of ownership was related to his theory of identity, that is, what I own is me. And the mixed race piece set down the results of my thinking about race as it pertained to me. I was literally mixed race, but the US system of racial identification did not allow for that because of hypo descent or the so-called one drop rule. So I was officially Black, but in reality, I was and am mixed race. I was hired at SUNY Albany as a tenure track assistant professor in philosophy for the fall of 1991 under a target of opportunity affirmative action program. I felt uneasy about this, but I wanted and needed the job. So I committed to continue writing about race to justify my good fortune and, as they say, give back. My first book, Race and Mixed Race, grew out of my personal exploratory thought about race. My writing about race became more detached, but I've continued to write about subjects that interest me, to which I think I can contribute at a given time. Most of my subjects have not been standard philosophical topics and questions or even the literature on new subjects. Instead, the best way I can put it is that my career trajectory has been based on philosophizing the unphilosophical, although I haven't identified it under that description until quite recently. And in what remains, I'm going to talk about my work, and then I'm going to talk about my work life, and then I'm going to talk about teaching and pedagogy. So this is a section about my work. If race is real, then the rule of hypo descent is bogus, and mixed race may be real in society. In 1996, I edited an anthology, American Mixed Race, The Culture of Microdiversity. The same year, my monograph, Bachelors of Science, 17th Century Identity Then and Now, was published. The mixed race anthology combined multidisciplinary contributions from scholars and activists who advocated the assertion and recognition of mixed race identities. When I began, prominent members in the field had cordial interactions, but over the 2 years the book was produced, many of them fell out due to theoretical disagreement and disparate goals. I came to view mixed race studies as a rhizomatic structure of babble, because race itself is not real in the biological way that is assumed in ordinary life or even in mixed race studies. Bachelor of Science was an exploration of the pre-modern roots of identity, the early modern roots of identity, philosophy of science, and the foundations of modern political theory. It was something of a hodgepodge, but I enjoyed writing it, and I relearned some basics that were subsequently useful. For example, in the Ethics and Mores of Race, Equality After the History of Philosophy, which was 2011 and 15, I emphasized the importance of the Lockean idea of ownership for modern democracies, with the insight that ownership was unlimited, so that owners could own anything, including other human beings, and in terms of our contemporary environmental crisis, the Earth itself. I drifted away from the subject of mixed race because the reality of mixed race presumed the reality of biological race itself. In my 2002 Philosophy of Science and Race, I showed how four possible foundations for a coherent and independent concept of race in the biological human sciences, that is genetics, heredity, and anthropology, those sciences, all failed. So the ones that failed were geographical origins, genealogy, phenotypical inheritance, including blood types, and genetic inheritance. And I considered this the end of what Noah Rosenberg at Stanford has called the sideshow of race and philosophy. But of course, some intrepid philosophers still try to tell scientists how they should view their work to support the ordinary ideas of race as biological, even though the ideas of race contribute nothing in the biological sciences. I then turn to the societal side of race, including racism, which is all too real. I am grateful that my work in the philosophy of science and subsequent social and political areas have been part of a new field in academic philosophy, philosophy of race. For me personally, this field was officially recorded on the Professions Map of Inquiry with my edited collection of 51 essays in the 2018 Oxford Handbook of Philosophy and Race. My recent work includes six monographs, two of which were written quickly as their subject matter unfolded in news. I wrote most of White Privilege and Black Rights, The Injustice of US Police Racial Profiling and Homicide, 2015, during the 2014 winter break, and The American Tragedy of COVID-19, Social and Political Crises of 2020, during my quarantine summer of last year. Each was motivated by distress and alarm in reaction to unfolding events, but each developed as an inquiry. In the first, an inquiry into the ways the police anti-Black injustice is actually baked into the US judicial system. And in the second, how COVID-19 has been a tragedy in the United States in the classic sense of errors of judgment stemming from subtle traits of character in individuals and the collective. In a sense, the American tragedy of COVID-19 continues from my ethics for disaster, but the practical subject there was weather-related floods, earthquakes, and hurricanes. And its major thesis was that preparation is very important. The extended duration of the COVID-19 pandemic moves it into an existential condition beyond a disaster. And responses to it, and we really have to come to terms with this, responses to it have repeatedly shown the futility of advocacy for preparation. So what we're left with at best is crisis management. In the Ethics and Mores of Race, Equality After the History of Philosophy, 2011-15, I examined the history of political philosophy by contrasting ethics or abstract ideas of universal human worth and equality with mores or traditions of social hierarchy. I found that universal human equality was only first explicitly proclaimed in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. After that, all political theorists have quietly assumed it. Applicative Justice, A Pragmatic Empirical Approach to Racial Injustice, 2016, was constructed on the argument that in reality, justice is not motivating contra laws, only injustice is. In democratic societies where some do enjoy justice, those who do not and their advocates demand that justice be applied or extended to them. Reviving the Social Compact, Inclusive Citizenship in an Age of Extreme Politics, 2018, was a focus on the importance of the power residing in the people independently of government. In times of dysfunctional central government, this power can vitalize local organization and reform. Progressive Anonymity, From Identity Politics to Evidence-Based Government, which came out in 2020, supports the development and practice of identity politics in society, but within government itself, where it causes extreme conflict and division. And we're still seeing this play out. I there argue for boring government consisting of public policies aiming to benefit all of those governed. Without realizing it in these four books, I was building toward explication of democracy as a structure of government and society. So I'm now writing Democracy, a very short introduction for the Oxford University series. And I approach the history of democracy with the distinction between the concept and its different conceptions. Past government and societal structures that were called democratic, many of them do not strike us as democratic today. But rather than say that democracy is an ideal that has never existed or wax moralistic about the past, I use the idea of different conceptions of democracy to contextualize elitist, masculinist, or slave-owning democracies. I should add that over the years, I've edited three more anthologies and written two textbooks on race. I've also, pre-COVID, traveled extensively to give talks throughout the United States, mainly for my race-related work. Invitations from abroad, Paris, Copenhagen, Oxford, Tokyo, have stemmed from my work on disaster. And these travels obviously expand one's collegiality and scholarship. So now I move to talking about my work life, teaching, and pedagogy. Work life. I've had three institutional positions after my return to academia. At SUNY Albany during the 1990s, I was the only philosophy faculty member who was interested in writing and teaching about race. Feminism, and also feminism, existentialism, and other aspects of the newly permitted scholarship. The department was analytic, but my colleagues respected my productivity. There were minor disputes and a certain amount of what I would now call microaggression. I don't think my colleagues understood either my work on race or my own demographics. But there was also a common ground of intellectual values. My 11 years in the Albany Philosophy Department were an extended apprenticeship for academic philosophy. And I went through the ranks there, adjunct, assistant professor, associate professor, and full professor. In July 2001, I moved to Eugene, Oregon as a tenured full professor in the philosophy department at the University of Oregon. I had been recruited to strengthen the analytic component in the department and contribute to philosophical work on diversity as well as representative. My interests remained the same, but my academic role changed from being the unconventional member of a traditional department to the curmudgeon who defended the philosophical canon and traditional methods. The department was in transition from pluralism to continental and postmodern philosophy, which was sometimes delineated by phenomenological feminism. American philosophy, pragmatism, and philosophy of race were kept at bay. Latin American philosophy was somewhat neutral. Choices and methods in philosophical subject matter became ideological, and the department was intensely politicized. Fear kept junior faculty silent. Several gifted colleagues left when they had opportunities, and others felt they were driven out. There were two or three who remained calm and neutral. I was not in that number, but I learned how to surf the disputes and engage only when something serious and incontrovertible seemed to me to be at stake. I lost almost all battles, but I also became more productive during those 18 years, which saw my transition from biological to societal aspects of race and then to political philosophy. Political philosophy taken more generally. I also designed a website for homelessness and advised 12 PhD dissertations. I would have contentedly remained indefinitely had there not arisen the opportunity to teach at Lehman College, CUNY. And after I left Eugene, I left Eugene during the summer of 2019. After I left Eugene, this year a memorial Zoom event in honor of our beloved office manager, TK Teresa Kim Landazuri, who died suddenly on February 8, 2021. This event gave me a sense of genuine farewell or closure regarding that department. Although there is at least one colleague who I think is in the audience, who I think very highly of. You know, I'm not making a blanket criticism of the department. I'm really trying to relate it from my perspective, which I think can be done without being too offensive. My collegial experience at Lehman College, CUNY, beginning in fall 2019, has been harmonious with very little friction among colleagues. It's a smaller department with 5 or 6 compared to 10 or 12 members, and competition for graduate students is not intense because there aren't any. More importantly, the Lehman department is not ideological about preferred subject matter, but is instead genuinely pluralistic and thereby intellectually tolerant of different philosophical interests and methods. And I want to say something about graduate students. I believe I've advised and known exceptional graduate students over the years, and I want to mention some of them here. At SUNY Albany, I had one PhD student, Joe Zepitello, who went on to teach creative writing and develop his own literary career. Kara Osselman, my MA student, and Tom Reynolds, who has pursued physics as well as philosophy, have kept in touch. At the University of Oregon, I chaired 12 successful PhD committees. Among these graduates, Johanna Luttrell produced Global Feminist Political Thought, Claire Picard explored views on abortion, Selena Simpson analyzed W.E.B. Du Bois in terms of mixed race, Grant Silva and Jose Mendoza launched Latin American philosophy in the UO department with a focus on immigration and identity in the United States, George Forlis developed innovative ideas in Middle Eastern and international reconciliation, Al Frankowski produced evocative work on African-American memorialization, Lisa Yant wrote on women's memorialization, Paul Bircher expanded his clinical work in medicine to theoretical treatment of the doctor-patient relationship. Jason Jordan was a fine early modern scholar, and he now practices and teaches mountain climbing. Jasmine Gabriel wrote about theories of life and became a genetic consultant. Edgar Tiemann wrote about might makes right. At both the U of O and U Albany, I advised more students in their jobs strategies and was a member of other dissertation committees. I learned much from Matthew Faust and Jen McQueenie. Despite dire warnings about the job market in philosophy, since I returned to academia in 1990, out of scores of PhD graduates, most do get a job in philosophy if they want one. Sometimes the first job is not permanent. But persistence as well as the craft in putting together job applications does yield results. And there are also philosophy majors seeking admission to graduate programs. Speaking generally with degrees from less than elite schools, this has seemed to me to be more difficult than getting hired after the PhD. But here also craft plays off. And now I'm going to finish up by talking about pedagogy. At all three institutions, it has repeatedly been said, teaching is taken seriously here. It's literally true because we get paid to teach. One is hired, tenured, and promoted to teach in a department, although salaries vary according to publications and institutional budgets. But more is meant than that, because it is pedagogy that academic philosophers mean should be taken seriously. As a philosophy teacher, I follow John Dewey, who emphasized active learning. Philosophy students have a lot to learn. The written content and its related issues and questions is brought out in discussion, thinking, speaking, and writing about that material. Since I returned to teaching in 1990, student tolerance for reading has been in a steady decline. It is not only students who read less and less, but professional philosophers also. We tend to read what we must for our own teaching and writing and leave it at that. However, At SUNY Albany and the University of Oregon, for me, this was a slow boiling frog in a pot process. I encountered little real resistance to pedagogical and advisement structures that assumed students on all levels would accept an obligation to read. Lehman students have presented me with challenges that have made me more sharply aware of pedagogical methods and my institutional obligations. And it comes down to this. Many students do not like to read, including the syllabus. Many students do not like to write, and for many, English is a second language. Many students are not generally well prepared for college work. Some students do not like to speak or even show up. At an average age of 25, most students are adults, and they're less pliable than traditional undergraduates. Also, as adults in underserved circumstances with jobs, children, and other family responsibilities, their lives are difficult, and unpleasant problems and small disasters frequently occur. Their communities and families have been hard hit by COVID-19. Over 20% of my students are Hispanic or Black. Most of the Black students are immigrants or recent descendants of immigrants, and they identify as African American. Since summer 2020, I've been teaching online in a format that's fairly uniform for all courses, but the syllabi are quite complicated. All course components are described therein, especially grade components. All reading assignments are either on Blackboard or in a low-cost required book. A writing assignment on the readings is due once every week, twice a week or daily for summer school courses. And there may be a midterm and final paper plus, and this is important, extra credit options. Because of the pandemic, my classes meet once a week for video conference. Attendance at video conferences is about 2/3 of total course enrollment, the same as when I taught in person. Grade distributions have also been similar in both cases. But teaching online has forced me to jump out of the pot. In closing, I want to share some of my pedagogical strategies because I think that underserved minority students represent a collective obligation for all academic philosophers, and many students who are more privileged present the same challenges. The task, as I see it, is to teach the craft of philosophy, and the art of it can supervene on that. But you have to teach like you mean it. So here's how I'm meeting the five challenges in sequence. Many don't like to read, and this includes the syllabus. Well, this can be tedious for the instructor as the semester goes on, because one is repeatedly asked questions about the course, which were already answered in the syllabus. So now, the first assignment in all of my courses is a test on the important aspects of the syllabus, and further work is not accepted until that is done. The reluctance to read is evident when students make up a gloss of the subject matter of the required reading for the assignment. They just kind of make it up, you know, based on a general impression that they have. I can always tell. I tell them that their writing does not show they've done the required reading, and I grade accordingly. And since they know they haven't done the reading, this is not disputed. Many don't like to write. Writing is a requirement for learning philosophy. Their writing is often rough. I advise them to seek tutoring help, which is readily available on campus or now online. For many, English is a second language. And while I will not give a full A to those with severe writing glitches, I do read for what they mean rather than how they say it. And I also insist on citations and references for all their assignments, and that is well explained in the syllabus. Many don't like to talk or show up. I don't take attendance, but I do give extra credit for participation. I've realized I have to ask them the right questions and then wait. When they respond, the discussion can be very interesting and elevating, and they do care about their grades. And it seems to me some can put as much energy into disputing a B minus or an A minus as into the work itself. So I've realized that despite aversions to scholarly work, my students want the certification of a college degree. And I have authority over a component of that, namely their grades in my course. And this is my main pedagogical hook. Ideally, students would enjoy the work for its intrinsic value, and some do. There's no question, some do. Some just take off they get interested for its own sake. Two honor students I worked with last year, Devakumali Gavanisam and Victoria Smith, will be attending PhD programs at the University of Connecticut and New York University. Lindsay Huff is enrolling in the MA program at Tufts University. She's the third student who was not a Lehman student who took the disaster course. At Lehman, such success is a team effort throughout the School of Arts and Humanities. It takes a village to send a student to graduate school, and that's a good thing. We all pitch in. I really appreciate that. Many will, here's another challenge. Many may not be well prepared for college, but they're in college and getting admitted and registered by going through bureaucratic hoops complicated by an intricate electronic system shows that they are motivated to be in college and that a college degree is therefore valuable to them. My job is not to rubber stamp their progress toward that degree, but create systems that require learning. Most are adults, so like grown children, one cannot tell them what to do with an assertion of authority. And as adults in underserved circumstances with jobs, children, and other family responsibilities, their lives are difficult and unpleasant problems and small disasters frequently occur. Some instructors acting from compassion may accept excuses in place of work. I do not. I don't think it's empowering for students or respectful toward me. Of course, if there's a major emergency in a student's life, I'll give them an incomplete if they ask for it, and I support requests based on disabilities. But generally, I tell students that if I make the allowance they want, it would not be fair to the other students who managed to do the work, and they accept this. Let me add that Lehman students are very professional overall. There are no emails with the "Hey Naomi" salutation I had become used to at the UO. They call me Professor Zach or Professor. I find this bracing, not because it confirms the importance of certification to them. They respect the system and they believe in its powers to make their lives better. And I represent the system as someone from whom they can learn philosophy. But I'm not trained or employed as a therapist, a counselor, or a preacher. I'm only a philosophy teacher. I believe that if a certain grade is important to a student and one convinces them and they believe that they'll have to read and also minimally listen, think, and write coherently in order to get that grade, then they will perform tasks from which they will learn how to do philosophy. They learn the craft, and this enables the art. Imagination joins insight and creative thought emerges. Life choices can be recognized and informed decisions made. The Dewey Lecturer is asked to discuss the future of professional philosophy. I think this means, what do you think the future of professional philosophy should be? My teaching at Lehman College is inclusive pedagogy. Inclusive pedagogy can fulfill the promise of inclusive democracy and individual well-being. The intellectual work of scholars who attend to social problems and progressive projects is already recognized and established. So the future of philosophy is this dual inclusive expansion of pedagogy and scholarly attention. And I think philosophers should pursue in the future of philosophy meaningful scholarship, and that they should teach like they mean it. Thank you.